Can you see that clock?
3:35.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Yes. Okay, we'll call this meeting of the Senate Special Committee on Trans-Alaska Pipeline System Throughput to order at 3:35 p.m. on Tuesday, April 8th. We're in Butchovich Room 205. Today, present with me are Senator Gardner, Senator Fairclough, Senator McGuire. We may have Senator Dunleavy, Co-Chair Dunleavy, coming in. Let the record show we have a quorum to do business. I'd also like to note the presence of Senator Giesel in the audience and recognize our committee staff, Mr. Simmons, Nancy Jones from Senate Record, and Claire Gross, teleconference operator. So I'd like to also remind everyone to turn off your cell phone. My staff has written me cute notes. Purpose of the meeting today. So we have a lot of increased activity in the oil and gas business. Cook Inlet, a couple of jackup rigs working, a new platform is about to be installed. 2 to 3 conventional rigs being operated by Cook Inlet Energy. Sinks of gas storage operations. Aside from that, we have a lot going on just in everyday integrity management of wells and the regular things that happen in Cook Inlet on the North Slope. 20% increase in AOGCC-related activities. Repsol and Conoco conducting winter exploration activities. A large quantity of increased activity aside from that just coming our way. And one of my concerns that is shared with folks in the industry is just the potential of not having enough inspectors with all the work. So I wanted to have AOGCC come in. One of the reasons is to sort of educate Alaskans on what they do. We hear about them. I've heard them confused with AOGA and a lot of other different groups, but I wanted to have them here today for educate us on this subject and for questions and for possible action in the future on helping them in their mission. So with that, we're going to hear a presentation from Kathy Forster, Commissioner and Chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Kathy, if you can please join us, identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation. And I'm not real picky on when we ask questions, so if you have questions during the presentation, feel free to ask them.
My name is Kathy Forster. I'm the Chair and Engineering Commissioner at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or AOGCC. Good afternoon, Chair Machiki, Senators Gardner, Fairclough, and McGuire. I feel like I'm preaching to the saved. You guys are some of the smartest folks in town, and my valedictorian is in the background. And so you guys know this stuff, but I'm here to get it on the record for other people and be here to answer any questions that you might have. And thank you for this opportunity. The AOGCC is an independent and quasi-judicial body located in downtown Anchorage. Although located within the executive branch, by statute, the AOGCC is independent. This means that we do not report to any department within the executive branch, but certainly we are held to the same administrative requirements of any other state department. And why is that so? So that when the DNR comes before us, they're not held in any higher standing than any other applicant, because as a quasi-judicial body, we have to be fair. And if we report to the governor, then how can we be perceived as holding one of his cabinets not in a higher standing than Siri or BP or anyone else that comes before
us? Ms. Forster, Commissioner, can I ask you to hold your mic up a little bit higher? Okay, that's
okay.
It's a little tough to hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, good. By statute, we have three commissioners. One must be a petroleum geologist. Currently, that is Dan Seamount, and you guys all know him. One must be a petroleum engineer, and that's me. The third is a public member and is required by statute to have training and experience relevant to the oil and gas industry. The last public member we had was John Norman, but he chose to retire, and so that position is currently vacant. Two geologists, six engineers, seven field inspectors, and several IT, data management, and administrative support staff. I said we have positions because we currently have one engineering vacancy. And in the notes that you guys received, it says we currently have one engineer. The word vacancy was missing. Big difference. We have one engineer vacancy. And we're also currently trying to add at least one additional field inspector position. If you know, one of the things that Senator Machiki asked me to talk to you about was our biggest current issues, and staffing is one of the biggest ones we have. The industry is very active, which means that we are very active too. And we draw our staff, our technical staff, our inspectors, our engineers, our geologists, our commissioners, from the same talent pool as the industry draws theirs. And the industry's compensation is more competitive than ours, so it makes it hard for us to compete with them to get staff. When they need people, we need people too, and they have tools to get them that we don't. For example, the last two engineers that we lost left us for a 10% sign or more signing bonus, a 20% raise, and an all-expense-paid trip back to Texas to be closer to their family. You know, it's hard to compete with those sorts of things, and so it's a constant struggle for us to keep our positions filled.
Yes.
Sorry. Just a couple quick questions. How long has have these positions been vacant, the commissioner and the other ones? I mean, how long do you expect it takes to look for somebody? And the commissioner, I guess you don't appoint.
That's out of our control.
Right, and how long have you been missing one? And then the other question is, in terms of being able to pay people enough to compete, there we have precedent for exempting these positions from the normal compensation schedules, and we did that with oil and gas tax auditors. And have you thought about doing that, or can you?
Yeah. All right. Senator Gardner, through the chair, I'm going to try to remember every one of your questions and answer them all in the order you asked them. Field inspector position was a recently added position. We added it a couple of, we had one or two field inspector vacancies. We've recently filled the last one, and now we're trying to add another position. So we've had inspector vacancies, at least one for a while. And as Senator Machiki said, with as much activity as we have right now, we need more. But we didn't feel that it was appropriate to request a PCN for new positions when we had vacancies. That just, you know, with the state trying to be conservative on positions, we didn't feel like that was the right thing to do. But now that all of the inspector positions are filled, we're working to create a new one, and so then we'll have another vacancy there. The engineer position has been vacant for over a year, I think close to 2 years. And for a while we had two engineering vacancies, and then for a while we had a geologist vacancy that we got filled less than a year ago. Our commissioner vacancy occurred at the end of January, and although filling that vacancy is out of my control, I've had anecdotal stories from that multiple people have been offered the job but have turned it down because it doesn't pay enough. We have already sought and achieved an exemption for our technical staff, and our technical staff and the geologists and engineers at DNR are already getting a higher salary than their positions would normally allow. And in fact, our engineers and geologists get paid almost $20,000 more than the commissioners do right now. And given that we knew we were going to lose John and that Dan is only going to be around for another 2 or 3 years if we keep him till the end, we did put into our budget this year a raise for commissioners that will go into effect next year so that we'll get up to where we're making a little bit more than the people who work for us. And that will make us competitive with the director of oil and gas, of the division of oil and gas at DNR. But right now we're paid less than his assistants are paid. And didn't, you know, we don't want to be begging for money, but by the same token, we want to be able to replace vacancies as they occur. So we did put a raise in for next year to help us with recruiting additional commissioners. And so we work with the DNR on raises for our technical staff. We don't want to get one group out of sync with the other one. And we did work with them to get them raises. And we'll probably come back in a year or so and see if another raise isn't in order. But we want to be careful that we're not being greedy and overpaying. So, but those were all good questions, and we do work that, but we just don't. We try to be deliberate in doing it.
Thank you.
But I just want to illustrate a little something for the committee here that you used to compete with lower 48 positions of similarly qualified and adequately experienced field engineers. Used to. You no longer do with the demand in the lower 48, but you don't even come close to Alaska competing with Alaskans. So if you want the most qualified Alaskans, you're under market, well under market on.
We are, and we work really hard to get our inspectors' pay up to, and our inspectors, their jobs are some of the hardest in the state. I would compare them, the only thing that you could compare them to would be state troopers, but even that, I think these guys work differently, and when a field inspector is on the job on the North Slope, he's on call 24/7, and 1 o'clock in the morning, he might get a call saying, you know, get out of your warm bed in Dead Horse and take your truck out to the helipad to get out to North Star because we have to do a blowout preventer test, or get over to the hangar so we can fly you out to Alpine, or drive out to Point Thompson, or drive to Colville. And or not Colville, excuse me, you know, out to Ugaruk or whatever. So they're getting calls at all hours of the day saying we need you right now to come out and do this. And we try to respond to those things as quickly as we've called, because it costs the industry a lot of money to wait on us. And with a shortage of inspectors, we find ourselves having to strike a balance between getting adequate coverage of all of the inspections that we need to do and not slowing them down. So we miss some inspections and some tests, and we slow them down occasionally, but we try to strike a balance. And that's what it's like on the North Slope. For the Cook Inlet, when the guys are off slope, they're on call for the Cook Inlet 1 week and supposedly on vacation the third week. But even when they're on their vacation, because we're understaffed, they're essentially on call for Cook Inlet work as well, because there's just so much of it.
Commissioner, we have limited time, okay, and I want them to know what AOGCC does so they know why they care, okay, about the other issues.
Okay. I'll move on. Thank you. You keep me honest here. Okay. All right. The next slide shows our mission. I won't read that to you, but those are the things that by statute we are called upon to do. We exercise the police powers of the state of Alaska, and we have jurisdiction throughout the state, including offshore state waters, for conventional oil and gas, for coal bed methane, for shale gas, shale oil, and geothermal resource exploration and development. In addition, if a well is being drilled for other purposes, but we have reason to suspect that it will encounter unanticipated hydrocarbons or other hazardous substances, our statutes give us the authority to assert jurisdiction. In 2012, when SERI was drilling its underground coal gasification wells, they were not going to use our drilling safety methods, and so we asserted jurisdiction over their drilling activities. They drilled 5 wells, and on, I think, the 4th one, they got a kick, which, if you don't have a blowout preventer turns into a blowout. They weren't planning to have a blowout preventer, but because we had asserted jurisdiction, they begrudgingly did. I'm still waiting for the thank you note, but that was a joke. But it was very fortunate that we had the ability to assert that jurisdiction, and we did because nobody wants a blowout in Cook Inlet. Our authority covers resource management and conservation, drilling and well work operations, well integrity, and well safety systems. It covers custody transfer metering, those meters that ring the cash register for the state, and eventually it covers well abandonment at the end of a well's life. All wells drilled in the state of Alaska for oil, gas, or geothermal resource exploration and development must receive a drilling permit from our agency. Also, all remedial or recompletion well work on existing wells require a permit from us. The AOGCC also has primacy for administering EPA's Class II underground injection program in Alaska. Class II means injection of oil field wastes. And we do our own independent review, approval, and monitoring of injection of Class I wells. That's a higher level of stringency than Class II. But EPA wouldn't give us primacy on that, but we also oversee that to make sure that the state standards are met. We have statewide rules governing all of our requirements, but whenever an operator wants or needs pool-specific rules, they submit a request to us, and those rules are addressed in conservation orders. For example, in many of the Cook Inlet fields, they're highly faulted and stratigraphic, and so statewide spacing rules would not allow enough wells to be drilled adequately to recover the resource. And so they just have to demonstrate to us that that's the case and that they're not draining other operators, and we give them a special rule. There are a variety of other approvals that we address, such as granting exceptions and variances from our existing rules. We stay very busy. In the new millennium, we thought that would be an interesting count for you. We've approved approaching 3,000 drilling permits, over 2,900, approaching 6,000 sundry well work permits, over 1,200 injection orders, conservation orders, and other decisions and orders. We have several major issues before us. We try to stay a quiet little agency in the old tire shack behind Nordstrom's, but there are several important issues before us right now, and this is a list of them. I'll discuss each in some detail, and I probably saved the one that you're most interested in for last. As Senator Machiki mentioned, there's just a ton of activity in Cook Inlet. But offshore drilling in the post-Macondo world is clearly one of the hottest topics before us, ensuring that when offshore activity occurs, it's done safely. Thanks in no small part to the good work of the legislature, operators are coming to the inlet. Fury and Buccaneer have brought jackups, and they've been drilling for a few seasons, and they're making discoveries. On the downside of that, both of these companies have come to Alaska with a lower standard of regulatory compliance than we're used to with the big operators who've been here for a while, and that's required a lot of work on our part. But on the upside, as I said, they're making meaningful discoveries. In addition, Hillcorp purchased Unocal and Marathon's interests, and Hillcorp is very aggressively investing in restoring production to these fields. I'll refer you to the next slide, which is Trading Bay Field. If you see, Trading Bay was on a decline, and then Hillcorp comes in, and all of a sudden, Trading Bay is up to production at a higher rate than it was producing in 2003.
I believe Senator Gardner has a question.
Thank you. And you can just answer really quickly. But I remember a few years ago you were very worried about space in your just space for operating and your record keeping. Was that resolved?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, when our co-tenant in our building moved out, we requested and received additional budget to expand into that space, and we're there now. And I invite you all to come get a tour.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, if I might. The new developers, you said, have a lower standard of regulatory compliance. Is that, are you saying that they are less compliant with our regulations, or they've historically practiced in a place with different kinds of regulations?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, I can't speak to their prior operations, but most states are fairly similar, that most big oil and gas states are similar to us. But our experience with them has been that we find them cutting corners, making mistakes, not being aware of our regulations, you know, a variety of different things, all of which require greater vigilance by us and require our inspectors to choose to go visit their work more and let other people that we trust. You know, if we have to choose between going to observe something that Conoco's doing at Beluga River or going to see something that Hillcorp, as a new operator, is doing in one of their fields, we'll tend to go to Hillcorp because they're having some issues with that. And, you know, Hillcorp's a good company, and they're run by someone who knows Alaska really well, John Barnes, and they are striving to be our best operator. But they have a ways to go, and we're working with them to get you there. So you can see the Trading Bay production has dramatically increased. Swanson River is another example of Hillcorp's great efforts. So, you know, it's worth our time to work with them and get them up to regulatory compliance if this is the kind of result that we're going to see from them. And in addition, Cook Inlet Energy, as Senator Machiki said, they're out there exploring and they're turning things around in their fields. The increased activity level has certainly kept us busy. We're reviewing an unusually high level of custody transfer metering applications for people wanting to bring new production on. Our field inspectors are conducting more inspections and safety system tests. The new operators are having difficulty complying with our regulations, so inspections and incident investigations are up. We are currently involved in adjudicating some very heated disputes among operators and landowners. And our MAS inspection staff is being stretched to the max. As I said, we have to pick and choose what we do and what we don't do, and we're working hard to strike a balance there, but we do need some more inspectors. In the big picture, the increased activity is all very positive, as the increased production that I showed you demonstrates.
Just a couple of impacts of not having enough inspectors, which I think is a key issue that we'll be working on. Decreased. Pardon?
Oh, I was asking Anna if it was in the budget to put more.
Well, inspectors. See, it's yeah. The positions are funded by the industry. That's not really the issue, but just to fill you in on some of the specifics. I mean, decreased regulatory oversight. I mean, think about the Macunda and.
Exactly.
Gulf of Mexico. Delays, to industry as well. I mean, it affects project economics, makes some projects uneconomical just because you're waiting for those delays. The tests are mandatory, so sometimes you're waiting until they have someone freed up, and they can be on weather delays or they can be on other delays where they simply can't come to your site. Overtime, I mean, the inspectors are working hard, so they're working overtime, which increased the cost dramatically. And the risk of an accident or injury from exhaustion, I mean, if you look at some of the other regulatory framework, a lot of it is taking into account exhaustion and long work days extended beyond 12. Some of them in the lower 48, PHMSA is starting to look at work schedules that are under 12-hour days. So just something to think about.
Right.
The less inspectors we have, the more they're working those hours.
Right, exactly right. And we have put in a request for a new PCN for an additional field inspector.
Okay.
All right. In addition to Cook Inlet activity, North Slope activity is also up. And, again, that's in no small part due to the work of you guys. We're into the winter exploration season. Conoco's drilling one exploratory well this season, and Repsol has requested permits for 5 exploratory wells. And as with the new operators in the inlet, Repsol is a new operator, and they're putting a regulatory strain on our field inspectors. Remember, a few seasons ago, they had a blowout, and this season we're finding that there wasn't a regulatory cavalierness then with that caused the blowout, but this season we're noticing some instances where they're not doing things to our standards. And so one of the things I've got to do when I get back to the office is have a come to Jesus meeting with that head of Repsol down in Houston. So we take, you know, that takes some of our time away from the other things that we do, but it's really important that we do that. All right, so activity in the legacy fields is also up. For example, over the past 12 months, Prudhoe Bay has experienced a 35% increase in well work activity, and Kuparuk an 18% increase. Drilling activity is also up in both fields. And perhaps the best news is, you know, we look every month at a 12-month rolling average of decline in all of the fields. And for Prudhoe and Kuparuk, the average for the last several years has been 5 to 6%. But the last month that I looked at, a month or so ago, Prudhoe was at 2% and Kuparuk was at 4% on that rolling 12-month average compared to their 6%. That's turning a corner in the decline for those fields. And on top of that, both Conoco and BP continue to work at unlocking the enormous potential of the viscous oil on the slope. And Conoco is working towards development of CD5 and exploration of an expansion of its Colville development. We're also expecting renewed well work activity, possibly next year, from Exxon as it moves towards starting up its Point Thompson cycling project. And we're hopeful, knock on wood, all of us, that as Great Bear completes the evaluation of its exploratory data, that they'll be back with positive results and a plan to bring Alaska into the shale business. Hydraulic fracturing has recently become a nationwide topic of interest, but hydraulic fracturing is not new. We've been fracturing wells in Alaska for over 40 years, and right now 24%, about a quarter of Alaska's wells have been hydraulically fractured, and the number's increasing. The AOGCC has been regulating hydraulic fracturing since the beginning, since the first well was fractured. We just completed a multi-year effort to modify our regulations. First, to keep up with technology advances. Second, to address fracturing fluids disclosure and water quality monitoring. And third, to gather all of our regulations into one section so that it's easy for the public to see, one, that we are regulating, and two, how we are regulating hydraulic fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing is commonly used, well understood, but it carries a lot of mystique with people outside of the industry. And I'm not going to say anything more about hydraulic fracturing other than to make an offer to you guys that if any of your constituents call concerned about it, you can refer them to me. I am quite versed at addressing layperson's concerns about fracturing.
Senator Gardner, good question.
Thank you. It used to be said that one of the impediments to expansion of hydraulic fracturing was access to water, and that's really about the lower 48, and then they started recycling and reusing stuff. But as we look at Great Bear and their proposed expansion, I mean, depending how far it goes and how fast, is water going to be a problem for them?
Water is not so much a problem in the state of Alaska as it is. It's not a problem everywhere in the lower 48. Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. when I was out there talking to their shale people, water's not an issue for them. They got plenty of water. Water's an issue in Texas and New Mexico and Colorado. And
arid places.
Right. And we got lots of water in the state. So, but you know, should water become an issue, the technologies that those arid states have caused to be developed can certainly be employed here. There are lots of real and imagined issues with fracturing, but they're not going to be issues for us up
Thank
here.
You.
Commissioner, I have a quick question for you as well. And I'm thrilled to have new players in the state. What's the potential for us to help with some sort of a program to exchange best practices between some of the traditional Alaska producers, which happen to be larger, and some of the new players that you're somewhat struggling with?
Senator Machiki, thank you. Very good question. One of the things that we do whenever a new player comes to the state is we reach out to them and ask them to bring their engineering and operations management into our office to sit down with all of our technical staff to discuss what the what their development plan is and what the likely issues along the way are. We also refer them to some of the good eggs that we know in the state and ask them to reach out to them. And I've also been known to suggest a name or two of people that they might steal from other companies who know how to do it right. So we're doing that informally already.
Okay.
Headhunters.
Well, you might think about that, and we'll be discussing these over the interim, but the legislature may want to help with some sort of formal training for new operators or something. I mean, those things cost a little bit of money, but the value is undeniable. So,
well, you know, one thing that we've talked about is, you know, when DNR gives somebody a lease, there's no vetting. You know, if you can come up with the money and hire somebody competent enough to submit a bid, then you can get a lease. And yes, there are requirements of that lease, but there's no vetting to demonstrate that, one, should you have a problem, you're going to be able to come up with the money to fix it, and two, that you got enough smarts to avoid most of the problems. And so, you know, you might talk to DNR and see if there's anything that they might think about as far as vetting operators that come to the state, too. All right, enough of that.
Well, I have to say, I've been in the field for smaller companies, and I've been in the field for larger companies, and a lot of us are really thrilled when the smaller companies come in. Some folks just don't like large companies, but they bring a level of expertise that we should be sharing with
right.
with newer players, whatever size they are. I mean, the Arctic is challenging, and whatever we can do to reduce the state's risk mm-hmm. is good business.
So, I agree. Thank you.
Okay.
Another issue before us is suspended, orphaned, and other wells that need to be cleaned up. States like Texas and Oklahoma have thousands of orphaned wells. Alaska has only a handful. But we don't want to let down our guard and let this become a problem for our state. So my agency has a constant effort to hold operators accountable for properly plugging and abandoning wells that have no further utility. The only operator we have a major problem with in the state is the federal government, and I think all of you guys are painfully familiar with the BLM travesty wells. And thank you, Senator Faircloth, for that name change. It was Senator Giesel. Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I'll vote for you, I promise. The bad news is that those wells are still a problem, and that it's a problem that generally gets worse with time. But the good news is that thanks to you guys and Senator Murkowski, Congress has given BLM $50 million to apply to their cleanup. And the even better news is that in a total change of personality, instead of saying we don't have to follow your rules because we're the federal government, BLM is working really closely with us and with DEC to try to meet the state standards, which are much higher than their own. So that's really good news, and I want to thank you guys for that because your work has been instrumental in that. All right, I'm on that last.
Senator Faircloth has a question.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question. I have a comment because Ms. Forrester has pointed out that BLM has done the right thing, and the Resource Committee specifically has been not necessarily happy with their past practice. So I just want to do a shout-out to thank those at BLM who are responding to our concern about how they've participated in Alaska's history and look forward to a future that has better relationships. I appreciate that they're responding. Thank you.
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, amen. This is it. This is the last one. Of course, ALGCC has a small but important role in the seemingly never-ending question of when are we going to sell North Slope Gas. Remembering that earlier slide outlining our mission, the ALGCC is charged by statute to prevent hydrocarbon losses and ensure greater ultimate recovery of total hydrocarbons. Those two charges have enormous implications around North Slope Gas sales. In the world of petroleum engineering, it's a simple truism that taking gas from an oil field puts ultimate oil recovery at risk. That's like saying, if I let go of this pan, it's going to go down, not up. It's just a given. Prudhoe Bay is an oil field with about 2 billion barrels left to produce. That's bigger than any of the biggest discoveries that have been made in the lower 48 in the last 15 years. What they started with. We got 2 billion barrels. That's huge. And Point Thompson is also an oil field, by technical definition and by the state of Alaska's legal definition. So the ALGCC is responsible for determining when and how much gas can be taken from those fields so that waste does not occur and that greater ultimate hydrocarbon recovery is achieved. ALGCC developed some white papers a few years ago to address the questions that are most frequently asked about what our role is, what our concerns are at Prudhoe Bay, and what our concerns are at Point Thompson. I've asked that those be included in with your information, and if you're having trouble sleeping, I recommend that you read them. In addition to the field-specific issues discussed in those papers, there are a few other issues to mention. First, it is possible that the best use of the gas at Point Thompson will be to inject it into the Prudhoe Bay gas cap to get perhaps an additional half a billion barrels, my approximate guess, out of the Prudhoe Bay reservoir. And that's going to be a question that BP, Conoco, and Exxon know they have to answer before they get a gas offtake. Second, as Conoco and BP work towards finding ways to unlock that huge potential of viscous oil on the slope, it's highly likely that gas will be part of the solution, and they know they need to answer that question for me. But on the other side, on the more positive side for those of you wanting a gas line, if we build it, they will come. The USGS estimates 150 trillion cubic feet of undiscovered gas on the North Slope, and nobody is going to go out and explore for that gas if there's no market for it. So if we build a gas line, if there's a gas line being built, that exploration is likely to begin. So the only other thing that I, Representative Seaton, asked that I remind you guys that in sometimes when I go to Senate Resource, Senator Willikowski asks me, well, aren't we just wasting all of that gas, burning it in flares and using it for fuel, and shouldn't we quit doing that? And so I developed and showed to some of you last time I was here what I call my Willikowski graph, and he's very pleased that I've named a graph after him. But what it shows is that if you look just at BTU content, that out until 2028, we're producing a higher value, fuel value product than the product that we're using to get it out of the ground. And it won't be till 2028 on a BTU basis that we're using as much gas as we're getting oil. And I made the most conservative assumptions possible, so it's possible, it's more likely further out. But then if you put a dollar value to those two products, then it's out. It's off my graph. I'd have to put a cheater bar out on the end of my graph and put it out to maybe 2050.
Commissioner, do you have the graph?
I have my graph. Would you like to see
and
it?
And so you're again talking about at current decline rates.
Right, at the 6% decline
right.
rate,
okay.
Not in the rest
which,
of decline.
Which
rate.
We know right now we're 4 and 2. Is that correct?
We're lower than that.
For
right.
2014. Right.
Would you like me to come up and hand it to you and let y'all pass.
Oh, if you don't have it electronically?
I don't have okay. it electronically, but I certainly...
Sure, we can pass it around if you want to share. Talk about it.
And that graph is the BTU, and it's just that one graph. There were some other attachments. Please ignore them. But that graph is the BTU content graph, and if you applied price to it, it would push it out off the graph, So I didn't create that graph. But I just wanted to allay the fears of those people that, you know, are lighting the torches, saying we want our gas now. They're holding our gas hostage. The operators are really doing the best thing for the state of Alaska by using that gas to produce more oil right now. But the closing comment that I want to make.
Just if I may,
please.
Commissioner, but also there are other options for EOR.
Oh, definitely.
So if they, I mean, if a project is economical and they choose to produce the gas, there are other methods of lifting the other hydrocarbons as
right.
well. Right.
And the last thing, that's the last thought I want to leave you with is that the monkey's on the operators' backs to demonstrate to us and to you that selling the gas from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson is the best answer for preventing waste and ensuring greater ultimate hydrocarbon recovery. We are looking to BP, Conoco, and Exxon to do that, and they know that, and they're doing it, and I guarantee you they're not going to spend big bucks to build a line if they don't think they're going to be able to prove to us that it's the right thing to do. And if it's the right thing to do for them, it's going to be the right thing to do for us. We are aligned with them on this.
That's an interesting comment, because I don't think a lot of people realize that in the state when it comes to hydrocarbon production. So, questions from the committee. We have a few minutes before we have a member that is going, that I hope isn't watching, has a retirement surprise. Oh, sorry. He's not watching. Questions? Yes. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Kathy, for all your work and wisdom through all the years that I've been here. And I just wanted to bring up something that happened and then ask you the open-ended question. Is there anything we need to know that we don't know right now with respect to oil and gas development? And I want to bring you back to the debate over the AGEA-led line and the discussions that were ongoing in the Palin administration, back and forth, forth and back, and nobody ever called you up and asked you to come to the table to testify whether or not 4.5 TCU a day was even feasible. Very interesting. Whether it was practical to pull that out of the Prudhoe Bay production unit, and you would have said no. You would have said 2.4, perhaps. And so I learned that later, and I thought that it was an oversight on all of our parts. And so I just ask you today, maybe you want to comment on that, but more importantly, we're looking at, of course, the gas line bill that's moving through with a memorandum of understanding, heads of agreement, those kinds of things that are incorporated in it. Is there anything you want to say about that? And then any of the other bills that are out there that you think that we need to know something from your expertise about?
Well, the first thing I want to say, Senator McGuire, through the chair, is that over my years of working with you guys, I have really come to trust and respect the four of you and many of the and in the entire legislative body here. We have some really smart cookies and people who take this very seriously, and you guys generally reach out to us when you have a question that you think we can answer. I want you to continue to do that. But what I want to say about this gas line and the likelihood of it being, what the right answer is and what the right timing is, in general, the later it is and the lower the rate, the less the losses will be.
Okay.
And in general, because the later, the less oil that's left in the ground, the lower the losses will be. And the more things that the operator plans and puts in place to mitigate those losses, such as their current process of gas cap water injection and looking to see if CO2 can be used as EOR and other things like that, the more of those things that they have tried and proven before there's a gas line, the better off we'll be. But again, I want to go back to what I said before, that they're not going to do it if it doesn't make them more money and more hydrocarbons. And if it makes them more money in hydrocarbons, it's going to make us more money in hydrocarbons. And my job is just to, it probably won't be me, it'll be somebody else, but the AOGCC's job will be to ensure that they have dotted the I's and crossed the T's and done that analysis.
Yes, ma'am.
So on that point, I was looking at an article from Petroleum News in which BP's Dave LaChance was talking about reservoir development and about viscous oil and heavy oils. Things. Is gas needed to develop those more than is used for currently?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, gas will likely be more, there will likely be a greater gas need in that, because there'll likely be a greater fuel need. Heat,
yes,
might be part of the solution, and fuel would be needed to get that heat. Reduction of viscosity through both heat and maybe in inserting a lighter fluid like the gas might be part of the solution. So we will be, we've already communicated to Conoco and BP that we're looking to them to help us see where gas fits into their viscous oil development as part of our determination of is it time and how much.
So,
but yes, gas is likely to be instrumental to viscous oil recovery.
Okay. So is it accurate then to say that to the extent that viscous oil will be sort of the key to increasing oil production as opposed to simply reducing the decline, does that adversely impact options for gas export?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, you're much more optimistic than I am about viscous oil. In my opinion, viscous oil will never stop the decline. Viscous oil will be a small contribution to decreasing, to slowing the decline. But viscous oil won't turn it around.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I just wish that we had some reporters in the audience. A report that says that we've got a 2% decline instead of a 6% on Prudhoe Bay is shocking, is a word that I've seen in headlines recently. It's amazing. It's great. Everything that you're indicating to us is that we've got a little bit more activity than we've had in the past. And so I appreciate that and hope that will get onto the airwaves so that people know that things are moving in Alaska's direction on the recovery of hydrocarbons on the North Slope and bending the curve, which is what we talked about in the last legislative session.
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, don't get an arm cramp, but pat yourselves on the back. You guys have done a lot to incentivize the increased production.
That was part of my interest in this today, was also having an actual state agency that's, again, quasi-judicial and independent, giving us a statement. People believe some things, and I don't know anyone who doesn't believe the AOGCC, so we're happy to have you here. Very much appreciate your time, and we are going to adjourn, and we may have you back. I kind of want to get into some of the technical aspects of what your folks do that we don't generally cover and that bore some folks, but I know these committee members would be fascinated, so we may be back in touch. Thank you again, and with that, we are adjourned at 4:25 p.m.